Session number 5201, Reel 3.
Wartime filming, Martin Gray, Reel 3.
Everything was lying around, burning and all twisted and mangled, and we made our way back to the headquarters, only to find the door shut with a notice pinned on, "Come back to Amiens as fast as you can." Well, now, we didn't know what the score was, because, I mean, to us, they didn't know that there'd been a breakthrough on the side, as there had been, because we were still up in this salient in the middle. So anyway, we went down the road, and of course this was at night time, and we finished up going down the road in the darkness, and there were refugees everywhere. And we eventually finished up at Amiens, which was quite a way back, and got there to find that everybody was packing off, hightailing it off to Boulogne. Most people had gone. And we were the sort of behind legger, so to speak. And the car was playing up. It was only running on four cylinders, or five, basically, because the gasket had gone between two cylinders. Anyway, and I couldn't do anything about it because I hadn't got any spares. The spares were on the truck, which had... I don't know where it was. I think it was on its way to Amiens or something like that. Or how it hadn't left and they couldn't unload it. That's right. So anyway, we went down the road and we got to Boulogne. I never did get the spares because the road the Germans closed the road after us with one of their panzer tanks. And the lorry never did reach us. And I got back to Boulogne to find everybody in a state of confusion and chaos. Nobody knew what it was all about. And we were in a hotel down there. I can't remember which hotel it was. I think it was the Morris. And so we spent the night there. And I said to Freddie Bayliss, who was Paramount cameraman at the time, Fred, who spoke very good French. My French was not up to mechanical engineering French. And I said to him, "Will you come with me and let's find a garage and see if we can get something done with this car?" So anyway, he came with me and we found this little tiny garage around the back, and the Frenchman said he would do what he could for us, but he hadn't got the right gasket. And I said, "Well, I'm hoping that I will get a gasket for you by tomorrow morning." Well, tomorrow morning came, and of course we then learnt that the lorries had been cut off up there, and we were no liable to get any of our spares or any of our spare film or anything like that. We were only left with what film we'd got. So I went back to Freddie with Freddie, this man. He said, "All right." He said, "Leave it with me." He said, "I'll try and patch it up." Well, I never did see the car again, because that night we decided we'd better get out of town because it was getting a bit hot. And somebody found a rather nice chateau outside, which was empty. People had gone. So we all congregated out there.
You say we all. Can well, you describe, I mean, who that was?
We all. These were the correspondents, the writers, the still photographers and the movie people.
You were still in a coherent group.
Oh, yes. Yes. We'd lost one or two on the way, but, I mean, I don't say physically lost. I mean, they may have gone somewhere else. But basically, we were all still in one group.
Was Charles Martin with you?
Yes, he was. Yes. Charlie was with us at that point. But then after that, I don't know what happened to Charles. Oh, yes, he came out with us. That's right. Charles was with us. So was Freddie Bayliss, Norman, myself. Who was the other one? There was another one. Jack Cotter had gone back. Jimmy Wright wasn't with us anyway at that point.
Was Harry Rignold with you?
Harry was there, yes. Harry was there. And I think he came back with us. In fact, I'm sure he did. We had people like with us, and Ted Artis only, the artists and these sort of people. Also, they were all with us. And Brian Negrino, the illustrated news artist, drawing, man who drew. All these sort of people. And we all went out to this chateau. Well, there was about 30 to 40 of us, I suppose. About 30, not 40, no. And we only had four vehicles because... all our vehicles, they only brought down absolutely the minimum number of vehicles, and some of them were out of commission. And we managed to get hold of a small Renault van, which we used as transport, because, I mean, the place was an absolute chaos. There were refugees everywhere, lorries, cars, civilian cars and everything else, British Army transport, all lying around the place, and you couldn't. You had great difficulty in getting through the streets with a number of people in them. Anyway, we got out to this place, and we stayed overnight and a couple of nights. And the following day, they said, right, we'll go down. We couldn't all go down. There wasn't enough room. I said, I stopped behind with three others. And they said, right, well, we'll send a car back for you. All right,
fine. What equipment did you
have? I didn't have any equipment at this point. My equipment was in the car. Norman had his... I think Norman had his movie camera, his still silent camera with him. He went down to the town, and I said, if you want the equipment, see Freddie Bayless. He can tell you where the camera equipment is and where the car is. And I then they went, and then four to five hours later, I was getting a bit worried. Charlie Martin came back for us with the little Renault van. And he said, we've got to get down. He said, we have got an hour to get down to catch the boat, and it's the last boat going. I said, Christ, what's gone wrong? He said, we're surrounded. He said, we've been cut off completely. The Germans are right up the coast, and we're in a pocket surrounded. I said, oh, charming. He said, well, you better drive. He said, you're much better at driving on this thing than I am. So I literally forced my way down. I really did have to force my way through the crowds and people, but thank God we had this little tiny van, otherwise I wouldn't have done it. And we got down to the headquarters and say, there were Captain Flood and another man, I can't remember his name, nice little man. He said, go on, to the quay, get the boat. We said, aren't you coming? He said, no. They said, no, we're staying, we're clearing up, and then we're coming on later. And I said, well, look, they're the keys of the car. The car is in such and such. I don't know whether it's ready or not. If it is, get it. And if you can't bring it out with you, dump it. Fire it, do anything. Because I had no time to do anything. I said, I want to go and get some equipment. No, you can't. You've got to go. If you don't go now, you won't get out. So anyway, I scrambled up the gangway. We left the car and we all scrambled up the gangway. And we were the last people on board as we got up, so they took the gangway away. And we got out. I believe, in actual fact, there was one boat afterwards out of Boulogne. But we had no problem at all getting away because there was no aerial attack or anything like this.
Was any thought being given at this stage to photographing the evacuation?
No, nobody seemed to bother with it. I don't think anybody photographed a thing. We certainly couldn't, because I couldn't record. I've got nothing to record with. And I don't think Norman had any more film. And Norman hadn't got the car. Either he didn't see got to the car, either he didn't see Freddie until it was too late and he was ushered off to the boat or not. But I know he got his camera, but he hadn't got any car. I hadn't got any film. And the BBC had got some of their equipment, but they couldn't record because they hadn't got it all. Nobody, it was so much panic that I don't think anybody, movie-wise, got any pictures. Well, none ever shown in my pit. I can't remember as such.
Charles Martin did get film of people coming off the beaches at Dunkirk.
Ah, yes, well, that's later. That was when he was back. I'm talking about coming off Boulogne. Coming out of Boulogne, there were no pictures taken, because I got a feeling it was late at night anyway. It was getting towards darkness when we left. Or afternoon. Anyway, it doesn't matter. There were no pictures of it, as far as I can recall. But Charlie did that later. Charlie was sent down to Dover to get something and found this thing was going on. And this is where it was so wrong that the War Office never alerted anybody to go out and get pictures. Charles was the only pictures that were ever taken of the evacuation of Dunkirk. There were no other pictures taken, and he only went just by accident. And as everybody said, lovable bloke that Charles was, he wasn't basically an Israel cameraman. I'm not decrying him in any way. He was more of a studio documentary cameraman. And the wrong man, not the wrong man was sent on the job, or rather finished up by doing it. No discredit to him, because he got what pictures he could get. But it really needed an experienced man to be there. Because Charles Lovell, when I loved him dearly, great person, a great raconteur and everything else, but he was, and he would be the first to admit it, a studio cameraman. If you said to him now, he said, oh yes, he would say, I was a studio cameraman, I wasn't doing documentaries and this sort of thing. He said, I wasn't an usual cameraman. But then we came back and we re-kitted up, and from then on I did the back to the normal sort of things, of the obviously pictures of all the French troops that came with the British troops as well, and all the army being refitted out with clothing and this sort of thing, and the WVS feeding the troops and all the people coming back, because we were back fairly early, you see. We could get it that we did a lot of this filming of the Dunkirk boys actually in camps and so on. That's where I spent most of my time, around the camps. And then afterwards, it was again the general scene of the build-up of production lines going, people making shells, aircraft and so on, and the build-up, and then, of course, the Battle of Britain, in which I was in the southeast London, and I was remember sitting in my little back room with a microphone out in the garden and the camera set up in the back room, recording the Blitz on London. Bombs falling and the shells winding down, the bits of shrapnel and so on. And I think I did this for about a week, because half the time I never got anything really worthwhile, because you were never switched on at the moment you should be switched on, because 1,000 feet of film only lasted 10 minutes. And if you didn't happen to be switched on the right moment, there was a great big like this. Well, if you didn't get the whistle of the bomb coming down, you might not as well have bothered to switch on.
Your cameras hold 1,000 feet.
That's right, yes. 1,000 feet of film, which is 11 minutes. You see, 90 feet a minute. And if you didn't, and so I expended quite a lot of film. I eventually got what I wanted, but half the time you switched on and switched off, and as you switched off, so something happened. A great salvo of guns went off and a bomb burst in the distance or something like this, and you didn't get it. Anyway, I did it for about a week, because we had our cars and equipment with us. The idea was to diversify it as much as possible so that it wasn't all knocked out of being in one place. The cars were garaged, and you were always garaged in one place in London, but in this case we all had our cars with us. So that everybody, all the firm's cars were dispersed, and all the equipment was dispersed. And we were also on the telephone to be called any moment to go and pick up a cameraman and go somewhere, because in that time I had no fixed cameraman when I came back off the Boulogne bit. I was sort of free to go with anybody, and this is what happened. I don't know, I always find it a very unreal time after that section of the BEF. It was just a normal sort of run of the thing, but it was all in uniform as opposed to being in civilian clothes.
You lived at home, did you?
Oh yes, sure, yes, yes. I lived at home. My family were evacuated to out to Buckinghamshire somewhere. But I elected to stay at home on my own. I stayed in my bed. I don't to hell with it. If I got my number on it, it'll get me. And I used to sleep absolutely soundly. And people used to say, did you hear the terrible night last night? I said, not a word.
And when you went on an assignment with the forces, did you wear a uniform?
Yes, yes. If it was a forces do, yes. And if you were a war correspondent, we weren't all war correspondents, not all of us. Some of us weren't. Some of them weren't. Some of the cameramen were not war correspondents. Some of them went to Alf Tummel, one of our cameramen. He joined up with the Canadian forces as a Canadian cameraman. We weren't all co-opted in immediately. Later on, yes.
But you yourself were an accredited cameraman.
Oh, yes, I was accredited correspondent, yes. As a recordist in those days, yes. Accredited, but we weren't all accredited. We had all got passes and so on, which said who we were and so on, and the others, and which they showed to police and people like this, and were allowed to go around. But there were only a limited number of us actually in uniform at that time.
And those were the ones who obviously concentrated on the service material.
Yes. Yes, but I mean, it wasn't always. What you've got to remember is that sound wasn't always used all the time like it is nowadays. Sound was used only on certain specified occasions when it was necessary. In the normal course of events, it was all done with the silent camera, and the sound was laid on afterwards. The general sound. You know, if a silent cameraman went into a factory making of tanks or anything like this, it was general background, a family background, off records and this sort of thing, of banging and crashing and so on and so forth. No real syncing up of sound, metal on metal and this sort of thing.
Was there a trend, though, during the war for a greater use of real sound to be made?
No, for the very simple reason that there weren't, A, the cameras. They were still very bulky, you must remember. And basically, all your 90% of all your picture taking was done by silent cameras, mute cameras. I don't think the Army Film Unit had a sound unit of any sort. And as I say, the only sound unit that ever went abroad was myself and Paul. And it was only used on very sparing occasions. It was all silent work.
And can you speculate as to why British Movietone was the only company to have a sound unit abroad?
I think we were the people who put up the idea. We put up the idea, and it was generally agreed that we managed to force it through, that we put the idea up. Several of the companies were very reluctant to go ahead with this at all. They said it was a waste of money. And it was then eventually decided that they would put one unit out. They never did put more than one out. And even in the push through northern France into Belgium, Holland and Germany, there was still only one. That was us. We didn't start with it in the beginning, but we were the only one with it all the way through. I think they decided that they would pay for one, but no more, because it was quite an expensive item. Let's face it. Not in terms of money nowadays, but certainly in terms of money in those days, because it took quite a lot of upkeep. But sound certainly did not come into its own to any great degree. Recordings were obviously made, but they weren't made with any idea of war. I mean, war recordings, we recorded war, yes, certainly we did. We did it in Italy and this sort of thing. But this is probably the only authentic recordings, film-wise, on film.
Can you recall now the incident where Leslie Murray was injured?
Yes. We all went up to do an army exercise for the Royal Engineers, near Doncaster at Bawtry. And the idea was that they wanted to experience in blowing up a bridge. And there was an old disused canal bridge, which nobody wanted. And they decided they'd blow this up. So they sent us up there. Two of us went up there, Leslie and Jack Carter. And Leslie was going to do the close work. He was within a sort of 100 yards of it, 50 to 100 yards, and we were probably a quarter of a mile away. up on a bank, on the canal bank, sort of giving the general scene when it blew up and the plume of smoke that went up with it. And Leslie with...
plus the bang.
Oh, yes, of course, yes. Plus the bang, yes. I was in the recording car down the other side of the bank. Jack was up on top with the sound camera. Leslie was farther forward with Stanley Kessel of the Times, or ex-Times photographer, who was an official war photographer. Under a table to give them protection from the falling debris coming down. And the bridge was supposed to blow up. What happened was, in actual fact, the charges were badly laid and the bridge blew out sideways. And there's a picture from Leslie's camera of the pieces of masonry coming towards him. And bricks, you know, great lumps of brick like this coming towards him and hitting the ground in front of him, hitting the camera and hitting him. It killed Stanley Kessel, who got head injuries and died in hospital. And Leslie had his leg smashed. And he spent almost a year or longer in Doncaster Infirmary having it put together by a doctor who wanted to take his leg off. And Leslie said, "No, I'm not going to have my leg off. You've got to repair it." And he often said to me in years later, he said... you know, he said, "I wish I'd had it off now." He said, "It's given me so much trouble." But
did you film the Blitz in any cities?
Oh, yes. Obviously in London, because this is where I was stationed. And London was the prime target at that time. One went round to various places down the underground and saw the people on the underground and so on. But basically one didn't do much sound, very little sound as such. There was, it was all silent film. Except if when you went down, as we did on one occasion, or I didn't, but somebody, one of the other companies went down and took a crew down there and had there was a piano down there and sing song on the underground platform and entertainment and this sort of thing, but I didn't personally do this. Now, I got involved in the Blitz in... I went up to Coventry, but only aftermath of Coventry. But I actually got involved in Plymouth. I went down to Plymouth. I was sent down to Plymouth to join up with a cameraman, and I got to the edge of the town, and I was stopped by a policeman with a barrier across the road. He said, "Unexploded bombs." So I said, "What's happened?" He said, "Well, didn't you know there was a Blitz here last night?" I said, "No, I didn't." So I left early this morning. Not had any radio on. We didn't have radio in the cars in those days anyway. And so he said, I said, "Well, I must get in because I've got to be in Mountbatten tomorrow because there was a big ceremony or something I had to do in Mountbatten." And he said, "Well, the only way you think you can get in," he said, "if you go up that road round the back there," he said, "you'll have to sort of feel your way in," he said, "because as far as I understand, the whole town's sealed off." So anyway, I eventually got into the centre of Plymouth by devious little back roads, which were barely wide enough for the car, and turning around and finding it blocked one end and having to come back and go and try another one, and met up with my cameraman. And I said, "How are you?" He said, "Oh," he said, "you had a terrible night last night." And I said, "Oh, dear." He said, "Well, I don't know, you might get some dinner." He said, "I don't know, the gas is off, the water's off." He said, "They are rustling up something." Anyway, we sat down to some soup for dinner. And as soon as we sat down, the sirens went. And with the sirens went, the place was lit up by incendiaries. And they just rained incendiaries down for half an hour or 45 minutes, and the place was well alight, and then they proceeded to bomb it immediately afterwards, and this went on all night. And I couldn't get, but I'd put the car away under the arches, the railway arches, in a special garage, and the bloke had taken the key away and I couldn't get at it. Not that I would have done very much, even as such, because I spent half my time lying on the floor as the bombs came down. But Dick went out and shot some pictures. And I spent half my night moving furniture out of shops as the fire went from shop to shop down the street. Because there were no fire engines, or rather there was no water in the town. And the only water they could get was down at the Hoe, which meant bringing it something into the centre of the city, something like 3.25 miles or something like this. And they hadn't got enough hoses. So the place just literally burned from one end to the other. Missed our hotel, I'm glad to say. They kept the bar open all night, which was the best thing. But it was quite frightening, it really was. I had 2 nights of that. But I wouldn't have changed. Looking back on it, you say it was frightening, but it wasn't.
Did you find out what the morale of the people was like?
The morale of the people was fabulous. I didn't ever find any morale, anything but good morale wherever I went. And I travelled around the country quite a bit because I was always out and about and around up in Liverpool, Coventry, and all the places that have been bombed at some time or other. But I never found anybody whose morale was being sapped to the point where they couldn't go on any longer. I believe that some people have said this, but I never came across it. They were always very much, they're not going to get us down.
I think that your next major assignment was to go with Paul Wyand on board the Duke of York with Churchill to meet Roosevelt.
That's right, yes.
Can you recall that?
Yes, very much so. We were told that we had a special thing to do, that we were to take warm clothing with us and to take plenty of film and for the camera, 2 cameras we took, a movie a sound camera and a mute camera. And we were told, we weren't even told where we were going. And then it was cancelled for 3 days. We then found out why it was cancelled, because the Repulse and the Prince of Wales had been sunk in the Far East. And 3 days later, it was on again, and we were on a train to Scotland. And on the train to Scotland and to Gourock, when we were then taken down by train and then ferried to, out to, which turned out to be the Duke of York. And even then, I didn't know whether Paul did, I don't think he did. Up to that point, did we know, until we got on board the boat, where we were going and what we were going to do? And Billy Horton turned round, he said, well, I can tell you now, because you're on board the boat, we're going to America with Churchill. He said, at the present time, he said, I don't know where we're going to in America, but we're going to America. And we were slipped out of the Clyde with an escort of 6 destroyers, and 2 days out, the weather got so bad, we had 4 11 gales, so bad that the escort, we slowed and slowed, and the escort couldn't keep with us because the destroyers were having a hell of a time. And in the finish, the captain and Churchill said, Churchill said we must go on alone. And so everybody agreed that no U-boat could operate in conditions like this, because they were really foul. And so we went on our own. We